This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry. I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
In October 1975, 21-year-old Teresa Knowlton traveled to Bangkok, Thailand, looking for enlightenment along the hippie trail. With her bare feet and cut-off jeans, Teresa fit right in with the counterculture. She marveled at the beauty of the Buddhist monasteries throughout the region. On October 15th, her last night in the city, Teresa met a motley crew of travelers led by a handsome man who called himself Alain Gauthier. Teresa drank and danced into the night. Eventually, Alain proclaimed his love for her. He declared that she and he and all the rest should venture out to Patpong, the red light district, where they could continue the party and get to know each other more intimately. Teresa hesitated. She had plans in the morning. But the more she looked into Alain's eyes, the more she wanted the night to go on. 3 days later, a farmer rode his bike along the Gulf of Thailand, about 90 miles from Bangkok. As he pedaled, he noticed a white woman in a flower bikini floating face down in the rising tide. He jumped off his bike and into the water to help her. As he approached, he realized this young woman was dead. Teresa Knowlton was the first victim to die at the hands of Alain Gauthier, a con artist whose real name was Charles Sobhraj. In less than a year, at least 10 more people would die at Charles Sobhraj's hands. The lifelong con man would graduate to serial killer. Welcome to Con Artists, a Parcast original. I'm Alastair Murden. Every week, we peel back the layers of history's greatest deceptions and tell the stories of the hustlers, swindlers, and fraudsters that orchestrated them. I'll dive into their psychology, break down their tricks, and explain why anyone might fall for a con. You can find episodes of Con Artists and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Con Artists for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Con Artists in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. This is our second and final episode on Charles Sobhraj. Last week, we explored Charles's troubled origins. A boy born with no identity and no love from his parents who turned to petty crime as a cry for attention. he never grew out of his crooked tricks, finding new ways to swindle strangers all the time. This week, we'll follow Charles as he transforms from a small-time con scammer into a serial killer and see how he recruited a Manson-like family to help him commit his crimes. By 1974, 30-year-old Charles Sobhraj had been imprisoned in France for Grand Theft Auto, smuggled cars in Bombay, and abandoned his brother, André, in a Turkish prison. He was ruthless, impossible to tie down, and his criminal behavior had only just begun. In 1974, he perfected a simple yet effective scam. Charles stationed himself on the hippie trail, the road between Bangkok, Thailand, and Istanbul, Turkey. Because he was half Indian and half Vietnamese, he easily blended in and could pose as a helpful local. He often claimed to be a local gem dealer or photographer, and offered his services to help guide lost tourists. Once he gained their trust, he either robbed them blind or coerced them to smuggle precious gems. For over a year, Charles roamed Southeast Asia performing his scams. And in May 1975, he was in the midst of executing this exact scheme on a couple of French tourists when he met a young Canadian woman in northern India. Marie-Andrée Leclerc was a 29-year-old French-Canadian who had never traveled outside of her home country. In 1975, she decided to visit India, where she met the famed French-speaking photographer Alain Gauthier in an airport. Alain, of course, was Charles Sobhraj. Charles pursued Marie, and she fell head over heels in love with him. But eventually, her vacation came to a close. Charles begged her to stay and travel with him in Bangkok, but Marie hesitated. After much deliberation, she returned to her life in Quebec. But she found she couldn't stop thinking about her whirlwind romance with the mysterious Alain. Then he started writing to her, near daily letters, each one professing his ardent love for her. She tried to ignore them, continue living her life, but the letters were too beautiful. Her love for him became harder to resist with each passing day. After several months, Marie became convinced that Charles was the man of her dreams. And so, in August 1975, she returned to Southeast Asia for good and reunited with her lover. By September, Marie was completely devoted to Charles and willing to do whatever he asked of her. She had unknowingly committed herself to a ruthless criminal and was soon a partner to his crimes. That fall, Charles and Marie met a young Australian couple vacationing in Pattaya, a town about 2 hours from Bangkok. Charles and Marie inserted themselves into the Australian's vacation, and within a few hours, the four were getting along splendidly. They invited them to a remote beach, a local secret, one of the best in the area. Away from the crowds, Charles and Marie slipped sedatives into their coconut milk, and before too long, the Australians passed out. Charles and Marie ransacked their belongings, stealing their passports, wedding rings, jewelry, plane tickets, and thousands of dollars in cash. Once they woke up, the Australians reported the robbery, but by then, Charles and Marie were long gone, on the next bus back to Bangkok. Before Marie, Charles had recruited family members to run his cons, namely his half-brother André and his wife Chantal. Now, he realized that he didn't need close ties to recruit an accomplice. Soon, he started constructing his own crime family. His next convert was a young Frenchman named Dominique Renelot. Charles met Renelot at a cafe and drugged him, then dragged him back to a hotel room. When Renelot woke up, Charles claimed that he was suffering from dysentery and that Charles had saved him. Too sick to move, Ranelow put his faith in Charles to nurse him back to health. And in that time, Charles made sure that Ranelow would be his. Next came two young former French colonial police officers, Yannick and Jacques. Charles plied them with alcohol, then sent them out for a night on the town with Marie, during which time Charles broke into their room and stole their money and passports. When the men returned to find their belongings missing, they turned to Charles for help, unaware he was the culprit. He offered them a place to stay until new passports were issued, and they became unwitting friends to their robber. Finally, Charles recruited a young Indian man named Ajay Chowdhury. Their meeting remains something of a mystery. According to journalist Thomas Thompson, by mid-October, Ajay was suddenly sitting at the dinner table with the others on a nightly basis. But despite his mysterious arrival, Ajay soon became Charles's number two. By recruiting these people into his cause, Charles had reached a level of manipulation that he had never before enjoyed. His ever-increasing ego would drive his behavior to an even darker place. He would graduate from con artist to murderer. At some point in 1975, Charles was negotiating a lease for a building that he wanted to convert into a legitimate gem business. According to journalist Thomas Thompson, Charles needed to raise $25,000 by January 1, 1976, or the deal would fall through. Given his need to rack up as much cash as quickly as possible, it's possible that Charles found it more efficient to murder than to con. 21-year-old Teresa Knowlton, a Seattle native on a journey of spiritual awakening, met Charles and his group while she was on her way to Kathmandu. On her last night in Bangkok, she had the misfortune of meeting Charles and joined him in a visit to Bangkok's red light district, Patpong. 3 days later, her body was discovered by a farmer floating near the resort town of Pattaya. She was wearing only her flower bikini. She wasn't the only out-of-towner that Charles took advantage of that fall. One other such tourist was a Sephardic Jew from Istanbul named Vitali Hakim. Vitali intended to get rich quick by participating in a gem smuggling operation in Bangkok. He planned to use the money he made to pay for a wedding to his beloved, a French woman named Charmaine Carou, who he had met in Ibiza. Yet, as time passed, Vitali's prospective gem deal had gone nowhere. He milled about in his hotel lobby, wondering what he would tell Charmaine when he met Charles and Ajay. Charles easily used his knowledge of gems to ingratiate himself to Vitali. As they spoke, Charles revealed that he knew the perfect place for Vitali to recoup his losses: Chantaburi Province. Charles and Ajay convinced Vitali to join them on a business trip there. They promised he would get a cut of the big jewel purchase they intended to make from the Chantaburi gem mines. Excited to make some money, Vitali eagerly joined them on a six-hour drive out of Bangkok. Yet, when Charles and Ajay returned from the voyage, Vitali was no longer with them. Yannick and Jacques, two ex-cops from France, asked where Vitali was. Charles claimed he'd left the group to stay the night with some friends he'd met in Pattaya. The others found this answer odd, given that Vitali's bags were still sitting in the apartment. Yet, despite this inconsistency, they did nothing about it. On November 29th, Vitali's charred body was discovered outside of Pattaya. To the police, it appeared that he had been burned alive. Given his charred state, they had little evidence about who had killed him. But the last man he was seen with was Charles Sobhraj. By December of 1975, Charles had likely already killed two people, but he still hadn't acquired enough money to pay for the lease on his gem business. With the January deadline approaching, Charles needed to make the rest of his $25,000 and fast. In an act of desperation, Charles used Vitali Hakim's passport to fly to Hong Kong and try his hand at the Macau casinos. He entered the building, excited to make his money. But as he approached a table, the dealer immediately recognized him. Charles had been blackballed from the casino years earlier over unpaid debts, and the dealer refused to serve him. He urged Charles to leave. If he stayed, he would most certainly be arrested. As Charles wandered Hong Kong, distraught and without direction, he stumbled across a young Dutch couple named Henk Bintanya and Cornelia Kokkie Hemke. Using his charm and wily ways, he befriended them and showed them a good time around town. Such a good time that Charles convinced the couple to come back to Thailand with him. He'd show them even more fun in Bangkok. Eager to see a new city, Henk and Cornelia agreed. The trio flew to Bangkok and continued to party around town. Yet, within a few days of their arrival, Henk and Cornelia were stricken with a mysterious illness. Charles had poisoned them. Charles graciously offered to take care of them. He even made sure to look after their passports and valuables while they recovered. But suddenly, in the middle of December, Charles's scam was derailed. Vitali Hakim's girlfriend, Charmaine Carew, had come all the way to Bangkok looking for him. And she had arrived right on Charles Subraj's doorstep. Coming up, Charles's murderous spree goes international and he begins to form a new family. Now, back to the story. In the fall of 1975, 31-year-old con man Charles Subraj had poisoned over a dozen people, conning them out of their personal belongings and stealing their identities. He'd fleeced his victims out of quite a lot of money, but soon this simple con was no longer enough for Charles. Within a matter of months, he'd killed two people, including Vitali Hakim, who he burned to death. Charles had thought he'd gotten off scot-free, but only a few weeks later, Vitali's girlfriend arrived in Bangkok looking for answers. When Vitali failed to check in with her, Charmaine suspected that something had gone awry. She traveled to Bangkok and visited the hotel he had been staying in. The front desk informed Charmaine that he had checked out and moved in with one Alain Gauthier. The clerk gave her the address. She raced over to see if Vitali was still there. She asked around the building if anyone had seen her fiancé. Word started to spread that Vitali had gone missing. While most people at the apartment only found this slightly troubling, Charles saw it as a threat. He decided to act. On December 15th, 1975, Charmaine's naked body was found in the water near Pattaya. The autopsy revealed that she was strangled to death. The bones in her neck were completely shattered. Once Charles began cleaning house, it seemed he was unable to stop. On December 16th, he evicted Henk Bintanya and Cornelia Hemke, the Dutch couple he had lured in from Hong Kong. They were still dreadfully ill from Charles's poisoning, so they did little to fight back when Charles and Ajay threw them in a car in the middle of the night. Charles drove down the road to Pattaya, and when they got to a remote section of the highway, he and Ajay dragged the couple out of the car. Then the two men beat the couple, strangled them, doused their bodies with gasoline, and set them on fire. When Charles and Ajay returned to the apartment smelling of gasoline and covered in dirt, no one seemed to question them about their odd appearance. Charles assumed that he had once again gotten away with murder. However, in private, his three other accomplices, Dominique, Yannick, and Jacques, began to suspect that Charles was involved in the deaths of all of these tourists. As they realized Charles may be dangerous, their situation grew all the more tense. Dominique was still recovering from the poison Charles had given him, and Yannick and Jacques had yet to receive their new passports. They were trapped with a murderer. Their suspicions only intensified when, on December 18th, the charred bodies of a young couple were discovered near Pattaya. The papers incorrectly identified the victims as Australians. However, the three Frenchmen correctly suspected that these were actually Hank and Cornelia. They knew they needed to flee from Charles as soon as they possibly could. Luckily for them, they soon got their chance. Just before Christmas, Charles, Ajay, and Marie used the Dutch couple's passports to travel to Kathmandu and hit the casinos. There, Charles met 26-year-old Laurent Carrière and 29-year-old Connie Jo Bronzich. At first, Bronzich was thrilled to meet Charles. When he told her he was a gem dealer, she showed him some precious stones that she had just purchased in Delhi. But Charles proclaimed that she had been swindled. Luckily, he would be more than happy to go to Delhi and help her right the wrong. Of course, his offer to help was merely a smokescreen for more sinister intentions. 2 days after meeting Charles, the young couple's burnt bodies were discovered just outside of Kathmandu. Bronzich had suffered multiple stab wounds, and Carrière's throat was slit. When Charles returned to Bangkok, he brought Bronzich's gems with him and sold them. But when he got back to his apartment, Charles discovered his home had been picked clean and his safe had been tampered with. When Charles was murdering strangers in Nepal, Dominique, Yannick, and Jacques had broken into the safe and discovered their missing passports. The passports were missing pages and filled with fake stamps. Charles had obviously been using them. With Charles out of town and their passports recovered, the three men fled to the airport, fearing for their own lives. They flew to Paris, where they told Interpol everything they knew about Charles Sobhraj. Charles panicked. He had no idea what the departed Frenchman knew, where they'd gone, or why they'd left him in the first place. He only knew they had found their passports in his safe. Therefore, they were a threat to him. He stewed about their disappearance for some time, but there was little he could do. He flew back to Kathmandu, hoping to forget his unfortunate turn of events. Instead, he walked directly into an ambush. In Nepal, he was greeted by the police. They had managed to connect Charles and Marie to Laurent Carrière and Connie Jo Bronzich's deaths. Once they realized the victims were Westerners, the police questioned various hotels about any missing residents. Bronzich and Carrière's names came up, and witnesses pointed them towards Charles and Marie. Charles, of course, deflected the police's questions. He claimed he was Hank Bintanya, a European professor on sabbatical. Marie was his assistant, Cocky Hemke. Both denied knowing the two victims. He had their passports to prove it. The police allowed them to walk free for now, but wished them to remain nearby for further questioning. Using this opening, Charles and Marie reunited with Ajay and made for the airport. On New Year's Eve, 1975, the trio left Nepal and landed in Kolkata, India. The next few months were a whirlwind of chaos for Charles, but he would stay confident throughout it all. Like many con artists, Charles embodied narcissistic personality traits. According to Professor Susan Krauss-Whitborn, Professor Emerita of Psychological and Brain Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, a key component of narcissism is a feeling of invincibility. The important link between the two, as Professor Whitborn notes, is that people high on narcissism cannot see or admit to their own flaws. It is highly likely that the more he got away with, the more times he escaped the hands of justice, the more Charles saw himself as being invincible to the law. This likely explains why he persistently traveled between locales where he was being pursued, and why his behavior grew even riskier. For the first 3 months of 1976, when he reached Calcutta, Charles befriended a young Israeli, murdered him, and stole his belongings. He then returned to Bangkok, even though he could be connected to 4 murders there. Instead of lying low, he proceeded to drug an American, Robert Grainer, then stole his passport as well. In March 1976, Thai police arrived to question Charles about the Bikini murders, as his killings had come to be known. Yet, when they arrived at the apartment to bring him in, Charles used his new alias, Robert Grainer. As the police were looking for Alain Gauthier, they let him go. While a police officer was supposed to keep an eye on Robert just in case, Charles ensured he looked the other way through a handsome bribe. Charles, Marie, and Ajay were allowed to flee Bangkok. Once the police discovered that Robert Grainer / Alain Gauthier had disappeared, word of his escape spread to the international law enforcement community. Dutch diplomat Herman Knippenberg was furious when he heard the news. He had been conducting his own investigation into the deaths of Henk Bintanya and Cornelia Hemke, and he was positive that Alain Gauthier was the man responsible. He pressed the local authorities to let him investigate. Knippenberg was given permission to search Charles's apartment. Unlike the Thai police, he and his men were able to find an exorbitant amount of evidence against Charles, including identity papers, cash, incriminating receipts, and a slew of items belonging to Teresa Knowlton, Vitali Hakim, and Cornelia Hemke. It was clear to Knippenberg they had found their man. Now all they had to do was catch him. Surprisingly, Charles had not run far. He, Marie, and Ajay had merely fled one country south to Malaysia. The trio hid out in the old colonial town of Penang. While there, Charles sent Ajay on a mission. After only a few days, Ajay returned with a packet of gems worth about $40,000, over $180,000 today. Charles wanted to fly to Geneva, Switzerland, and sell the gems there, but first, he and Ajay needed to take care of some business on their own. Charles instructed Marie to meet them at the airport that afternoon. Yet, when Charles showed up to meet her, he was alone. Marie asked him where Ajay was, but Charles refused to say a word. Marie was concerned, but felt there was nothing she could do. She and Charles boarded their flight and flew to Geneva without Ajay. Ajay Chaudhry was never seen again. Most people believe Charles killed him and buried him in the jungle, a brutal and final goodbye to the person who was once his right-hand man. Charles and Marie's trip to Geneva was brief, but lucrative. They left the city as quickly as they had arrived, then flew to Paris, hoping to reconnect and leech off of people from Charles's past. Yet all of his old friends, and even his own mother, rejected him and turned him away. Undeterred, with Marie by his side, 32-year-old Charles set to work assembling a new group of companions, a new crime family. In June of 1976, Charles and Marie were in Karachi, Pakistan, when they invited a young Australian woman, Mary Ellen Ether, to join the group as a gem courier. Mary Ellen was in Pakistan after a bad end to a relationship. The Middle East seemed like the perfect place to do some soul searching. What she found was Charles Sobhraj. With the potential of making some quick cash, Mary Ellen agreed to go with Charles and Marie to Thailand. Unfortunately, right after they laid out this plan, Charles and Marie discovered that Thailand's top news channel was broadcasting their faces in a search for Alang Gautier and his girlfriend, Monique. While Marie was rattled, Charles shrugged it off. As he told Marie, people were looking for Alan and Monique, not Charles or Marie. However, to ease her fears, Charles decided to change the plan slightly. They would go to India first. Charles, Marie, and Mary Ellen flew into Bombay in search of new opportunities. There, Charles found one in a young English woman named Barbara Smith. He convinced her to join his new crew as well. Always looking for his next big scam, Charles learned from Barbara that a large group of French postgraduates was on their way to Delhi. To Charles, this was a potential bonanza. He greedily envisioned all the cash he could fleece from 60 or so gullible students. But to make the 886-mile journey to Delhi, the group needed one more small-time score, something that would not only get them there, but also bankroll their stay until they hit the French students. Their victim was a young Frenchman named Jean-Luc Solomon. Details of Solomon's death are scarce, but it is believed that he was poisoned not with the intention of murder, but simply to immobilize. Unfortunately, the dosage proved fatal. For 2 days, Solomon suffered in agony and died at the hospital after a hotel maid discovered him. When they investigated his room, all of his valuables were missing, and Charles and his gang were long gone, on their way to Delhi to lay a trap. At the beginning of July, the tour group of 60 French men and women flooded the Vikram Hotel. When checked in, many of them were swept into a conversation with a man they had met earlier that day at the Taj Mahal, whose sole purpose was to make sure these tourists had a memorable time in India. On each arm was a beautiful woman. For 2 days, the three ingratiated themselves with the French group, drinking, sightseeing, fornicating. It was as if they'd known Sobhraj and his girls for years. On the final night in Delhi, they all gathered for one last dinner. Sobhraj pulled the tour leader aside and asked if he knew about a recent dysentery breakout in Thailand, the tour group's next destination. Sobhraj offered the group some preventative pills, though only a third of the students took them. After dinner, the pills kicked in. Men and women began to keel over in agony, violently throwing up all over the hotel lobby. The hotel manager ran to the kitchen to see if the tour fell victim to food poisoning. But a few of the students quickly realized that the only victims were those who took Sobhraj's medication. As all eyes turned towards the friendly local, they saw that he had already started for the door. A couple of the stronger and faster students managed to tackle Sobhraj before he could escape. And when the police arrived, they found him subdued, tied to a chair. Charles Sobhraj was arrested right then and there. And it would be nearly 2 decades before he saw the light of day again. Coming up, Charles finds a new home in Tahar Prison. Now, back to the story. In July of 1976, 32-year-old con man and serial killer Charles Sobhraj tried to rob a group of French tourists in Delhi. But Charles bit off more than he could chew. The poison he fed to the group kicked in too quickly. The tourists put two and two together and managed to apprehend Charles before he could escape. They called the authorities. the police took Charles into custody and went about searching for his three female companions. It took them 2 days to capture Mary Ellen, Barbara Smith, and Marie-Andre Leclerc. The Indian authorities quickly sussed out that Mary Ellen and Barbara were the weak links in the group. In less than a day, the two revealed every crime they had participated in since joining Charles, which included various robberies around India, as well as the drugging and accidental killing of Jean-Luc Solomon. After getting all the information they could from Mary Ellen and Barbara, the police turned their attention to Marie Leclerc. But she refused to give up her man. She believed that, even after all she'd seen and all he'd put her through, that perhaps that Charles who wrote those love letters was still there deep down inside. Perhaps she could bring him back. The police leveled with Marie. Mary Ellen and Barbara had already confessed. Charles was facing prison time no matter what. Marie staying silent would do nothing to help him. But maybe she could help herself. After thinking it over, Marie gave a 32-page statement detailing her life with Charles Sobhraj and every crime she'd seen him commit. Charles, on the other hand, refused to cooperate. For 2 weeks, he maintained that he was a Parisian merchant. But no one was buying it. Charles was not nearly as good at covering his tracks as he thought. Law enforcement agencies from all across the globe had accumulated mountains of evidence against him and all of his aliases. Interpol wanted him for trying to rob a jewelry store in the Ashoka Hotel. The Thais wanted him for the bikini murders. The Dutch wanted justice for the murders of Henk Bintanya and Cornelia Hemke. Nepal was interested in discussing the murders of Laurent Carrière and Connie Jo Bronzich. But at the end of the day, it was India's justice that Charles would face, as they were the ones who'd captured him. He was charged with the murder of Jean-Luc Solomon. However, even as the justice system presented incontrovertible evidence of his guilt, Charles never confessed to any of his other murders. Instead, he blamed them all on Ajay Chaudhary. Charles and the girls were taken to the notorious Indian prison of Tihar to wait for their trial. Tihar is India's largest prison and houses murderers and gangsters. Water and food were scarce, and if a prisoner wished for even the tiniest bit more to eat, it was up to them to purchase it. Charles quickly went to work, befriending the guards and inmates. Within a few days, he was able to manipulate them into smuggling him in more food than anyone could imagine. And despite radios being banned, Charles somehow had three in his cell. Charles knew how corrupt India could be. With the power of money, he was able to buy off anyone he wanted, including the prison guards. The looming question, of course, was buy them off with what? It isn't exactly clear when Charles was able to do this, but before going to Tihar, he managed to smuggle, by his own estimation, 68 carats worth of rubies and sapphires via ingestion. And when the time came, he used those gems as his currency. But the jewels weren't just used to secure a life of luxury. They were part of his plan to escape prison once more. Charles and the others waited a year before going to trial. Much of it had to do with the state of Indian politics at the time. India was in the midst of the so-called emergency. In 1975, civil unrest over electoral malpractice broke out across the country. At the behest of Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, whose election was called into question, a state of emergency was declared. For 18 months, elections and civil liberties were suspended, and many of Gandhi's political opponents were imprisoned. This pushed Charles's case to the side. It wasn't until July of 1977, almost a year to the date of his arrest, that 33-year-old Charles was finally brought to trial. Both Mary Ellen and Barbara testified against him. However, their testimony almost didn't come to be. In the weeks leading up to the trial, Charles allegedly sent them threatening notes. Though we don't know specifically what Charles said, the two felt compelled to attempt suicide. It's quite possible that Charles either threatened to have them killed or manipulated them into attempting it. The conditions at Tahar were horrible, and it is possible that Charles feigned empathy as a way of manipulation. Christian Kaisers, PhD, noted that to psychopathic criminals, empathy seemed to be a voluntary activity. If they want to, they can empathize, and that explains how they can be so charming and maybe so manipulative. Once they have seduced you into doing what serves their purpose, the effortful empathy would probably disappear again. Whether Charles did manipulate them into attempting to take their own lives, or the two felt the pressure of the mitigating circumstances, both survived. They were forced to testify. Barbara went through all of the details of her relationship with Charles and the various crimes she witnessed him commit. Mary Ellen, on the other hand, shocked the court by recanting most of her statements to the police. Originally, she admitted to the poisoning plot, but in court, she changed her testimony and said that Charles only instructed her to be friendly with Jean-Luc Solomon, nothing more. Despite Mary Ellen's reversal, the prosecution had nearly 40 different witnesses to speak to Charles's crimes. They were confident that they would secure the death penalty against him. On August 8, 1978, the court gave their ruling. As journalist Thomas Thompson writes, Charles was found guilty on three lesser counts in the death of Jean-Luc Solomon, culpable homicide not amounting to murder, drugging and administering stupefying drugs for the purpose of robbery, and voluntarily causing hurt to commit robbery. This essentially amounted to manslaughter. Charles was sentenced to only 12 years. Marie Leclerc was found not guilty. Though Charles had escaped the death penalty, that didn't mean he was finished being punished for some of his crimes. Not long after the Solomon trial, both Charles and Marie were convicted in the poisoning of the French tourists at the Vikram Hotel. It tacked another 5 years on Charles's sentence in Tahar. Unfortunately, we don't know the length of Marie's sentence, just that she also stayed in Tahar. What we do know is that in the early 1980s, Marie was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. She was released on mercy and went back to Canada. In April of 1984, she passed away. It was said that, to her dying day, she was still in love with Charles Sobhraj. For Charles, his 12 years in Tahar wasn't the abysmal stay that the majority of the inmates faced. He managed to buy himself a life of luxury with various bribes. But that didn't mean Charles wasn't thinking ahead. There was still a warrant out for him in Thailand, and it was valid for 20 years. Once he was released from Tahar, it was very likely that India would extradite him to Thailand, where he most likely faced the death penalty. So, in March of 1986, the 10th year of his incarceration, Charles threw a party. He invited both inmates and prison guards. During the party, he spiked the punch. When everyone passed out, Charles simply walked out the front door. But Charles never intended to leave India. A few months after his escape, he willingly got himself caught. He was convicted for the drugging and the escape. Enough time was added to his prison sentence that, if and when he was released, the Thai warrant would have expired. On February 17, 1997, 52-year-old Charles the Serpent Sabraj left Tahar Prison a free man. By then, most warrants for his arrest had expired, or any evidence from other cases had gone missing. And, much to Charles's delight, the world within those 20 years had forgotten who he was. He eventually made his way to France, where he relished in what celebrity he did have, charging money for interviews. And in the early 2000s, he was said to have sold the movie rights to his life to the tune of $15 million. For nearly 6 years, he managed not to break any laws, even claiming that he had retired from crime. However, that didn't mean the law was finished with him. In September 2003, 59-year-old Charles was arrested in Kathmandu. Less than a year later, he was sentenced to life in prison for the 1975 murder of Connie Jo Bronzich. Over the next few years, Charles continued to fight for his freedom, appealing to the Nepalese courts. He even wrote a letter to the then French president, Nicolas Sarkozy. But all of his appeals were rejected. Ultimately, in 2010, the Supreme Court upheld Charles's conviction. And in 2014, 60-year-old Charles was additionally convicted for the death of Laurent Carrière. In February of 2019, Charles, now 74, filed a writ requesting clemency. The Supreme Court gave the government 3 months to come to a decision, but the result of their decision is unknown. For now, it is assumed that Charles remains in a Nepalese prison. Charles Sabraj was a master criminal with little to no regard for anyone but himself. After a childhood of neglect, he realized that the only person he could rely on to survive was himself, even if that meant lying, cheating, and killing. From the end of the 1960s to the mid-1970s, the Middle East and Southeast Asia became Charles's criminal playground. Though his cons were hardly complex, he managed to carve a successful niche for himself for nearly a decade. But despite being known as the Serpent for his ability to slink in and out of prison, it was only a matter of time before his luck ran out. It is unclear why Charles has never attempted some elaborate escape from Nepal like his previous prison stays. Perhaps age has dictated that he fight legally. Only Charles knows that answer. And only the Nepalese government knows if Charles will ever walk the streets of Kathmandu or Bangkok or Paris again. Thanks for listening to Con Artists. We'll be back next week with a new episode. You can find all episodes of Con Artists and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Con Artists, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Con Artists on Spotify, just open the app and type Con Artists in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next time. Con Artist was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound designed by Anthony Valsic, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Erin Larson. This episode of Con Artist was written by Joe Guerra, with writing assistance by Abigail Cannon. I'm Alastair Murden.